hey, has anyone talked to Patches about anything literally in the past half year? In honor of Thrillist's list of the best movie props of all time, what movie prop would you most like to own in real life?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Neuralizer from Men in Black, because come on, who doesn't want to erase the memories of your enemies?
I am the broken shell of Matt Patches, and I'm going to pick the talking can of mixed vegetables from Wet Hot American Summer, mostly because that can of vegetables can suck its own dick, and it does it a lot.
I'm going to take the James Bond laser watch from GoldenEye, both because it's a prop in a movie that I like, and because I like playing the N64 game. My name's David the Seven.
All three of you, I'm David Ehrlich, all three of you people decided to pretend that these props were real and you could use them for the applications designed in the film, whereas I thought the question was more like, what prop from a movie, as like a rational human adult, would I like to have in my apartment? It's just an object that I own. I am going to, off the top of my head, go with one of the ones that did make Patch's list, although controversially, any one of the raining frogs from Magnolia. I always love those frogs. Would love to have them strewn about my apartment.
I'll have to think about what non-practical item I have while I enjoy the talking can of mixed vegetables from Wet Hot American Summer.
Weren't those frogs computer generated? Because I read a really nice quote about how they were dropped down into pre-existing spots.
No, I have seen the frogs in the flesh at an art exhibit at the Whitney last year.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 173. It's Tuesday, July 11th, and on this day, unverifiable but too good to pass up, on this day in 1988, Mike Tyson gave the Donald Trump Foundation $2 million for Donald Trump.
Yep, Mother Jones actually has a good article I just found about this from last August, so it totally verified it happened.
Ugh, fine. You know what I'd rather talk about than
Literally
Donald Trump and
anything?
Mike Tyson? No. The Thrillist's 100 Best Props article.
Katie.
The Patches.
Katie, I know you've been absent for a little while, but we do some other things before we do that.
No, I'm just saying, I'm just getting into it because it's our lightning round question and we're not making it a full segment on the show. And Patches is upset about it.
So I'm not
upset. Make sure everyone knows that they should read this article.
I'm not upset. I just worked a lot.
I especially want to hear from you all about your favorite props. We'll get into that.
I would love to hear that.
But before we get into the rest of it, I hear we have reviews.
Oh, shit, reviews? Okay. Yeah.
Isn't that what you were talking about?
I joke with you. Well... We have a few reviews this week. I'll read a couple of them. Maybe we'll save a couple for next week. Who knows? Sky's the limit. Thank you all for writing in after we had a little bit of a dry spell. Please keep it up. But first...
Well, the reason is... Wait, let me say that people are probably chiming in because I'm giving away two copies of the Blu-ray of Free Fire, the new Ben Wheatley film. And I'm extending this contest till the next episode. So you still have a chance to win if you want to leave... review on iTunes that uses the words "free" and "fire" in it. Then I'll know that you were part of doing it for the contest.
Give away while it was in theaters.
Ouch! Burn.
I'm glad that it's
that's some free fire from David Ehrlich right there.
I'm a big fan of the movie. I just didn't do so hot. But whatever it takes to get people to leave reviews, we appreciate it. Let's read one from C. Grossius, who says, "Get it together, David. Please feel free to fire David Ehrlich from this after he literally ate dinner on mic in this week's episode. 5 stars for everyone else, except for Mouth Sounds McGee. If you're going to constantly substitute hyperbole for actually discussion of your opinions, please bring a little bit more professionalism to this podcast that I get totally for free. You're all mostly really great. Thanks for the podcast." You know, that review left me on tenterhooks throughout all 3 or 4 of its sentences, trying to figure out where the tone was ultimately going to end up. And I think we all arrived at a positive place. So I'm going to say, was this review helpful? Yes.
I can't believe you guys let David eat on mic while I was gone.
It was literally inextricable from what we were talking about. So I cut out most of it. Don't worry about it.
I didn't think they could hear me. There were no there was no chirping about it. So, oh well, lesson learned. Kubrick Man says, love the wide-ranging topics, but gives us a pathetic 4 stars. But the bicycle horn at the beginning has got to go. A horn-free pod is fire stars, no doubt. I think they meant five stars, so I'm going to dock one star from their review. Was this review helpful?
No, he was saying fire stars so he can get...
He's got to say fire.
Oh, I mean, we should lose a whole nother star for my... this is all getting very complicated.
Probably.
Although we've always had the bike horn. We can't get rid of the bike horn at this point.
But this review was helpful in educating me in regards to the rules of our current contest, so I'm going to say yes. Wakelaw says, best free podcast with rapid fire. I'm catching on now. Discussions. This is one of my favorite podcasts. When I heard that they had no reviews last week, I ran to my computer to fire off this review to freely recommend and endorse this delightful and informative podcast. I don't have the free time in my life to consume all the pop culture they discuss, but listen to podcasts while driving or on my morning runs. When I have a free minute to check iTunes, I get very into the morning runs. I'm glad all the children on this.
This was a good contest.
When I have a free minute to check iTunes, I get very excited to see a new episode of Fighting, and I quickly fire up my iPhone to listen to it. I love Dave Seven's knowledge of Star Wars and comic books. He should charge for this knowledge, but he gives it to us for free. For free. Matt and Katie keep the free fire discussions grounded. My only complaint is with David Ehrlich. He is so negative, caustic, and condescending. I'm trying to look for the cute pun in that, but coming up. The others should free him from his contract or fire him from the podcast. Otherwise, two times over. On the other hand, I love it when Joanna Robbins enjoys the show. In short, amazing show, but fire Ehrlich and free Joanna. Keep up the great work, Bryce from Dallas, Texas at Wake Law. Was this review helpful?
It was
Bryce
joyful,
from Dallas secretly Bryce Dallas Howard? I felt like maybe we were heading that way.
Revenge.
That was excellent pun use.
That was wonderful.
5 stars.
All right, we'll run through two more. One star and 1 5. Less of critics and more internet trolls from Kafka 6780. Use to love you guys. I didn't remember that Kafka had such a
voice
in the English language. But you guys seem to hate everything except Patches, which pretty much loves everything the rest hate and the audience hates.
Which?
But have become so negative while acting so highbrow and aristocrat. What I don't understand about you guys is why you review the same type of movies always and surprised you don't like them. You seem to enjoy more artsy, indie, foreign, etc. type movies and less superhero nerdy movies. It is like you go out with redheads, and after the date, you complain that she is redhead because you prefer blondes. I am not saying these are the best movies in the world, but they are enjoyable. I believe you are detached from the basic moviegoer, which you will most likely consider a complaint, and look down on us. I can realize that I don't like a singer or type of movie, but also respect it that others do, and it's just not my type. Watch and review movies that appeal to your taste, so you represent the audience with similar taste. Otherwise, it's just insulting, which I find you guys constantly. Time to time, I check back in, and it's the same episode all the time. Even heard you are explain how reruns of other podcasts do better than yours? In business, that would be a hint for you to change something. Dismiss me if you want. You will most likely even insult me and write me off. But in the end, is what seems to be your problem, the...
You get cut off, or
it ends on a thud. It's like the end of the Rules of Attraction.
Look, I don't think we should.
You did prove the guy's point as you read it out loud.
Yeah, let's not insult Kafka 6780 because he makes a very important point, which I've learned a lot about.
I mean, let's not be too nice to somebody here who, you know, decides to kick dirt in our face, because I don't think...
Dave, you have to understand something. You have to understand, some movies are for fans.
Oh, my God.
Now, these movies are for fans, and critics,
Katie,
okay?
I
the
was not being
the filmmakers make it for fans, not critics, and the fans love them, and the critics despise them, so clearly they're
that
for
was,
fans
that
and not
was
critics.
Just my natural reading voice.
that I can attest to that. That's very true.
And I'm just saying, was this really helpful report of concern?
It was for fans.
It was very helpful for fans, so let's go with yes, but actually with no. And finally, a weekly hit from Holdwing. The ensemble is a great mix, but I could use more Dave Seven. I often find myself wishing, as the others fire off their opinions, that Dave 7 would interject more freely. Regardless, it's a great show that I look forward to every week. Was this review helpful? I'd say it was about as helpful as a shotgun in a firefight in a Boston warehouse.
Hey! Yeah. Well, it's a mixed bag, depending on if you've seen Firefight. But yay!
Free fire.
Free fire.
You just disqualified yourself.
I did just disqualify myself.
Patches, how much longer can people enter this free fire contest?
They have this week after this podcast comes out. And so the next one drops on Tuesday, and we usually record it about the day before. So you have a few days to try and get your copy by leaving an iTunes review.
Free fire.
Do it. More puns. Okay, so we wanted to talk about War for the Planet of the Apes, but Patches is the only one who's seen it, so we can't have a full-fledged discussion about it. But we've talked about this franchise a lot over the years. I keep seeing that people kind of saying, this is like a slept-on great franchise, like the three movies in the most recent Ape series. Obviously, Planet of the Apes is a series that's been around a lot longer. Anyway, that these movies are great and Matt Reeves is great at making them. Patches, where are you on the Apes bandwagon?
I think this is pretty fantastic. And I think that Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was, when I was watching War for the Planet of the Apes, all I could think about was David going, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes sucks. It's terrible.
Am
artless,
I
it's fake.
Lex G's interpretation of Tweety in your head?
Eight people understand your reference right now.
But all
please use something a little more mainstream.
Critics and not for fans.
Start their own YouTube series mocking Jeff Wells. So
I'm David Ehrlich. Welcome to the Oscar podcast. Anyway, I've actually been really impressed by these movies, and oddly enough, I feel like every time I go into one, I'm not excited for it at all. What was the Rise of the Planet of the Apes? Right, was the first one with James Franco.
Yes, it was originally called Caesar Rise for the Planet of the Apes. I have my original crew hat right here because I wore it yesterday.
Whoa! Oh, you went.
This
to
is
set,
the first Planet of the Apes movie I didn't get to go to set to, literally just because I was out of town otherwise. But like, I love this like weird motion capture experiment that's become a franchise.
Well, that's the pleasure of it, I think, right? It's not an action movie. Certainly, Rise of the Planet of the Apes has one maybe big set piece at the end, but I'm trying to remember what actually happens in that movie. Most of it is marveling at the Caesar special effects and then watching all these apes come together.
Hanging out.
Yeah, it's Caesar leading the escape.
You got Draco Malfoy getting murdered.
Mm-hmm. Right, shooting fire hose at the monkeys and stuff. So nothing happens. And then even in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it's a lot of this kind of melancholy tone. There's not a lot of action. It's Caesar organizing the apes and becoming more humanoid and having the standoff with people. But there's no, you know, there's a spurt of violence at the end. There's that incredible tank scene, and which
no,
and again,
awful,
David, you're in my voice. Hate it. Yeah,
who's a total fucking plot.
That's
the
second
Koba, yeah, the
what?
Evil
yes.
ape.
Yeah. Oh, I thought I'm sorry.
That's,
thought
he wants to be the terrorist it. Ape. Well, and then so War for the Planet of the Apes is definitely the culmination here. It's the end of a trilogy. It has a lot in common with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes in terms of the kind of the, well, it has Matt Reeves as a director from, what else did he do? He did
made Cloverfield.
He made the previous Apes. Ooh,
yeah. My good graces for Cloverfield.
Let me in.
And And he returns to that same like cool Pacific Northwest kind of vibe. I think this actually takes place in upstate California. And again, it's about Caesar. It's about Andy Serkis's performance. It's about him weighing his options. I'm going to get a little spoilery here. But this is early on. I'll spare you, David. Let's just say Caesar undergoes some serious tragedy in the movie, and it forces him to make decisions that liken him to Koba. You know, do ape. Ape doesn't hurt ape, but now there are apes who have actually turned to man's side of this war and are helping them in hopes of becoming free eventually when all of Caesar's troops are dead. So now he has to make the decision. Do you go on the offensive? Do you stoop to man's level and start killing? And it's a complicated film. It's about all sorts of diaspora and saving his people, and where do you go and how do you end conflict? And ultimately, the apes just have to watch as man consumes himself. Oh, God, who is the bad guy in this movie? Woody Harrelson plays a colonel who is just a total like post-Trump white nationalist neo-Nazi who has holed up in California and is, you know, going to war with everyone he encounters. He just wants to annihilate the world because he's so pissed. And Caesar just happens to be in his crosshairs.
Apes or just like everybody?
What?
Is he pissed at the apes specifically or like just he's
definitely pissed at the apes in the beginning of the movie. The apes seem to be the latest thing that has crossed into his crosshairs. And they eventually capture a great number of apes and put them to work building. What else? A wall. And there's a lot of parallels. You can draw a lot of parallels to what's happening in the world today and an escalation of that and an apocalyptic story for this apocalyptic, perhaps, moment that we're in. The one thing I mean, again, Andy Serkis is really incredible. Like, totally start that Oscar buzz, whatever. I just think the technology and what he brings to it from behind these kind of CGIs is really something special and unmatched in all of these blockbusters we get. And that's what I really want to focus on. It's a very serious movie. It's about weighing these options. It's about watching people die. It's about watching people or sacrifice. It's heavy. It's heavy stuff. And I saw a lot of the reviews that came out initially saying that it's so dark. It's so grim. You know, where's the levity? What do you think of that criticism, even since you guys haven't seen War for the Planet of the Apes, not necessarily in this context, but just like when we talk about serious movies that are handling issues about death and about war, I mean, what do you make of, well, where's the levity? When can it be funny?
Itself. I mean, it'd be like saying, watching War for the Planet of the Apes and saying, like, where are the chickens? I mean, like, what? It's unrelated to the story that could be being told. I mean, I may see the film and think that it's the heaviness with which it's told is hollow and not particularly engaging, and I may then decide that I miss the levity, and maybe that's where some of the critics that are coming from feel, but I just think, like, in a vacuum, that note doesn't really mean anything. There are a lot of movies that I think would be watered down if they had levity, and then there are very, very heavy movies like Schindler's List, which thrive off of their darkly, their morbid streaks of humor, and so, I don't know, I think that, it really depends on the film, but if the drama is not delivering War for the Planet of the Apes, then yes, I will say that it is probably self-serious and could have used a lighter touch. But
yeah, I mean, there's got to be a way. Oh, go ahead.
I think go ahead, Dave. Well, I think the tone, the seriousness is part of why I, too, see another one of these movies. I'm just like, oh, okay. I mean, are we just going to watch these again? And I have liked all of them. But I do think that, like, similarity of tone of, like, watching humans destroy themselves and destroy the apes, it's it does feel monotonous, even if the movies themselves.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a throwback to the way that the original series wanted to deal with those sort of issues. It's just now we've managed our technologies caught up. But I think that, you know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes had that nice little sequence where they, like, rediscovered a radio in, like, an old gas station, and these humans, like, had a moment remembering their society. And so I think there's always the opportunity to have breaths of air. I hope that it's not a grind, like, I don't know, like, almost a torture porn of misery grind.
Right.
But, you know, it's a hard balance to strike, and also if you're viewing this as a trilogy capper, it's probably going to have to take more serious weight just based on the two movies that came before it, and maybe that is going to be hard in a standalone film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that will ultimately be the perspective that I'm most, like, the storytelling perspective in the macro sense that I'm most interested in looking at this movie as a trilogy capper, because I think that we have seen so many astoundingly poor ones recently, and I think it has really sort of shined a light on why closing a triptych of stories can often be the hardest part. The setup often takes care of itself. The middle chapter has free reign to start with, you know, on the ground running and to end at an uncertain, darker, more intriguing place, and just all sort of be connective tissue down the middle. This is why my gut feeling is that the upcoming Star Wars movie is going to be praised to the high heavens before inevitably we come crashing down to Earth with the ninth one, regardless of who directs it, but especially with Colin Trevorrow. But
so not a lot of projecting there.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think off the top of my head what other franchise I'm thinking of in recent memory. I was just recently writing about The Dark Knight Rises again, which sticks out. But yeah, I think capping off these trilogies is as much of a slam dunk as an ending can seem, is often the most difficult part. Doing it well within the Hollywood structures, it's difficult. So I'm curious how you felt about it.
Does it feel like a? Well, does it feel like one? Like, is it? I mean, the trend of franchises now is that they never end. Like, does this actually feel like they're closing the story?
It does. It does. I mean, I don't want to get too spoilery about it. This movie does actually a pretty good job of. I mean, these are prequels technically to the original Planet of the Apes movie, and there are some ties to that film. This movie gets there on some level. But what's interesting to me is that it's still Caesar's story from beginning to end. He takes a, you know, his journey is weighing on him and it'll collapse. And that's, he kind of has to climb back up and take his people somewhere safe. Like, there's an obvious endpoint and they don't try and stray from it. Obviously life will continue for these apes, but this section of the story is over. And the one thing
It's funny to me that I complain about the modern thing is franchises not ending when Planet of the Apes really did it first.
Yeah.
So if War for the Planet of the Apes is the model of a restrained franchise now.
I was just reading about the TV movies of Planet of the Apes and like the failed TV series. And yeah, it's the endless series, but time travel, it's really an amazing thing. But
they like blow up the Statue of Liberty and Caesar turns and winks and... There's like a circle wipe.
Yeah, they really mastered the wink here. If we were concerned about the uncanny valley and eyes twinkling, he really has a glimmer in his eye as he winks to camera and points at you. The one thing I did want to say, two things. What was the levity? There is levity in this movie. One of the characters, Steve Zahn, plays this character, Bad Ape, who he's called Bad Ape because he has no name and he's been separated from the pack and he's been living on his own almost the whole time. And he's almost doesn't get there, but he's almost like a Jar Jar Binksian character to this movie. And just like, he's a silly guy who hasn't learned to be sophisticated like the rest of the troop because he's on his own and he's just a wacky kinetic guy, frantic. And, but that's levity because they embrace him and bring him into the group and want him to help. And he can be very helpful because he sees the world in a different way. Like, that's fun for me. And the real strength of this movie is how everyone, all the apes, and there's a few humans that help them too, can all become one unit and work together. It's not darkness if people can function as a unit. And in a great war movie mode, you know, they're escaping from jail or they're planning an attack together. This is war movie triumph. And a lot of it, I think the levity of the movie has to do with Michael Giacchino kind of aping. Hey! Classic.
Oh, boy.
War movie scores, like Ennio Morricone, Battle of Algiers, I was listening to today. And I'm like, yeah, this is just like what he's doing in this score. And it's just there's a scene where they're escaping from a jail that I keep harping on, and it's just so fun, and the music is really backing them up. And that's where I'm like, this movie understands genre, and that's its escape from like grim dark. It's never grim dark. It's just
Matt Reeves
serious
into his understanding of genre when he tackles Batman, and as per our conversation last week in Spider-Man, really makes something of a noir detective story out of that rather than just another bit of superhero mumbo jumbo.
I forgot that was happening. That's
exciting.
Well, it's
happening on paper right now. We'll see what happens. But, yep, that's War for the Planet of the Apes. Could go on. I have no idea how. Well, I do, but it couldn't get better, I don't think. This is a good way to end. Everyone should see it.
So for our mini segment today, this is a little bit of a thinker. We're just throwing it out there as sort of an open question. Over the weekend, filmmaker Chad Hartigan, also a film goer, he asked me to point out, who directed Wars from America, among other things, tweeted that he didn't understand why all movie tickets cost the same. Why should Spider-Man and A Ghost Story cost the same amount? The movies cost very different amounts to make. And maybe, as a filmmaker and a filmgoer who would like to see indie movies succeed better in theaters and really not just be relegated to VOD. He was hoping that maybe charging $7.50 for a ghost story versus $15 for Spider-Man or something along those lines might incentivize people to going to the theater. So I wrote a little bit of a riff on that note today that did not proffer any sort of solutions to this problem, but did suggest that I felt as though the main issue is not while the price, of course, the difference between $7.50 and $15 could absolutely make the difference between someone going to the movies and not going to the movies, I do think that the main thing about independent film is exciting. The biggest barrier is excitement. It's enthusiasm. It's getting people to want to go see a particular movie. Because when you want to just go to the movies and sit in some AC, you go and see Spider-Man 9 or whatever. But when you want to go see The Beguiled, The Big Sick, even something larger like Baby Driver, which is not necessarily an independent film, or Valerian, which is, technically, despite its £190 million price tag, you know what you want to see. You have it in mind. Someone has gotten you excited to see it. And so I felt that we needed to focus more on the excitement than anything else, because I think that lowering the price of independent film versus studio stuff could actually devalue those films. And when you start acting like people can pay less for them, soon you have people acting as though they can pay nothing for them, and then you end up with people not feeling as though they should have to pay anything to see something like a ghost story. So, but it was more of a putting it out there. It's not an idea that I agree with, although I do appreciate the spirit of trying to think of more ways to incentivize people to go to the theater and see indies. I just want to throw the question out to you guys and to everyone listening if you have any thoughts on the matter.
I think the VOD comparison is interesting because you will get like a price difference in like Morse from America, which is a movie I saw on VOD last summer. You know, sometimes the indie movies will be $6 as opposed to $7 for whatever the new blockbuster that's out there. So I see where you would get that idea from. And when you talk about, you know, you want to, if you just want to go see a movie, you'll go see the blockbuster. But I think about, you know, in the town that I live in now, there's one indie theater that's right downtown. It's near my house. It's easy to get to. It's a pleasant place to go see a movie. And I kind of feel the opposite. Like, I would go just see whatever is playing at that art house rather than go to the multiplex, which is not going to be as nice. I mean, I think that's a kind of specific town-by-town experience. But I think there are ways to, like, if you wanted to combine that with it also has cheaper prices, even if it has, like, more expensive concessions or something. I don't know. Like, that kind of creative thinking, I see what you mean about the slippery slope, but it seems less dangerous to me than people not seeing movies in theaters at all.
It seems like indie films should be more like opera or something, right? They should be more expensive.
Oh, boy.
The people who will go to the theater, I mean, yeah, it is dying, but isn't that the argument here that not enough people are seeing indie films in theaters? And to make them less expensive, they'll make less money. Why would we do that? They should be more expensive so the people who are dedicated and will see them in theaters as patrons of the arts will pay more and keep them alive and show them that there's a dedicated audience who will pay up for them by making them... by decreasing the value of them, they'll go extinct.
I'm going to say anything you do to differentiate an indie movie from what is like generally seen as a theater release runs the danger of ghettoizing like a bargain bin and becoming sort of like a pre-quality judgment, even though that's absolutely not what it is.
But we've already seen that with VOD, right? It's like if a movie goes directly to VOD, I think anyone is deluding themselves to say that they don't think it is somehow less than the other movies that aren't.
But I don't know if people even know.
I mean,
know
sometimes it will go...
They used to make that distinction, but with Netflix and everything, people don't even think that way anymore. They just turn on what's in front.
I mean, I'm all for direct to VOD, but even if it's like something that's being simultaneously released in theaters, sometimes that price does go up and what you're paying for there is not going to the theater. But then it'll like fall off once the theatrical runs over and just rotate into whatever VOD deal it has. But I'm a big fan of paying more on that side. I think if you have two movies in the theater and one's Valerian and decided it was, you know, too big to pretend to be a $7 ticket and the other is a ghost story, which is trying to entice you with a $7 ticket, I think in the end, to the casual person who doesn't know what either of those movies are, they're going to think that ghost story is somehow lesser or cheaper. So I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't see it working in physical platforms because I think it'll just seem like you're devaluing the experience. Like going to the theater is like what Katie's talking about. It's a thing where you go out and you drive and like that's already costing some people some more money if they're not like near an indie theater. But then you like make a night of it and then you come back and you get to talk about a movie. I think preserving that is good. I don't know. It's a tough problem. I'd be all for it in digital. Knock down digital prices
anyway,
all I want.
An interesting discussion to have. I'm glad that Chad raised it. Let's move on.
Twin Peaks when it first premiered, I guess 4 or 5 weeks ago. We're now halfway. Oh my god, okay. Oh, I've lost all track of time. I haven't seen an episode of Twin Peaks since the fourth episode. Not really for lack of trying. I kind of keep turning it on whenever I get a moment to myself, but it's something that requires focus to really enjoy it, and then also a lot of patience, because there's a lot of episodes that don't really That try your patience, like watching Kyle MacLachlan wander around a casino in a polo shirt. And I watched the original.
Hello!
I loved it. I have considered myself a David Lynch fan. I love that he gets to do whatever he wants. I love this entire show in theory. I really like that it exists. I can't bring myself to bring it back on. I'm going to at some point, but it is not at the top of my list. Guys,
it's
talk
like
me back
Sting
into
for
Twin
you.
Peaks.
You love the fact that he's out there making music. But you respect that, but
I mean,
you don't have to listen to it.
No, it's more. It's like I like that it is something that I think that I will like when I'm in the right headspace for it. But as a television thing that I'm watching after I cook dinner before I fall asleep, I'm
yeah,
finding it really
I can
difficult.
Understand why that may not be the ideal time to do it. And I think it's really difficult for me as a childless usurper to sit here and tell someone who is raising a little human. That they should be able to carve out a certain time to do this. Cause
a Lynchian journey in itself, raising a child.
Yeah, I think the most Lynchian journey. But it requires a very certain headspace to get into. A Sunday nights, 10 o'clock, turn to 9 o'clock, turn off the lights, it's great. I will say, as someone who's been enjoying this immensely, and, I've always enjoyed Twin Peaks. I think we've talked about it a little bit on the show before. Struggle with the second season, as everyone else has, although I greatly admire the Diane Keaton-directed episode, even though the story she has to work with is insane. I recently rewatched and really responded to Fire Walk With Me, which I found very, very unnerving as a portrait of trauma, of abuse, of living with it, of perpetuating it through the generations. I thought is really one of Lynch's most lucid and physiologically striking films, and I guess I can understand why it has, or had at least, a bit of a troubled reputation, but hopefully this new series can restore its value. But I thought that as a I love how the new Twin Peaks is unlike any other television out there, obviously. I love that we have no idea what's going to happen from minute to minute. I love that it has a completely different feel from the previous episodes of Twin Peaks, and there's always a little bit of a thrill when we revisit the actual location of Twin Peaks and get some of those old school vibes, but it's still married to this completely new thing. What David Lynch is doing with sound design, and he's really always done with sound design, but particularly here in contrast to previous Twin Peaks, I find so fascinating and so unsettling. There's a very palpable silence, the sort of like absence of light, the sterile feeling to it, which really gets under my skin. And as this plot begins to move into gear, I just find it more and more engaging. I'm really, it's tapping into the same part of my brain that was so activated by the show and the film and its heyday. There were some of those moments, the Dougie moments, as charming as I think Dougie can be, in pieces that tried my patience, sure. But there's something about giving 18 hours of screen time with no creative oversight to someone like David Lynch. You put yourselves in their hands, you trust them, even having watched all of Inland Empire, I still trust him. I think he loves these characters too much to let them down. He loves this world. He has too much of a purpose. And suddenly we got to the 7th, and in particular the 8th episode, which was as good, if not better, than everyone on the internet was breathlessly trying to tell me while I was on my honeymoon. and had no access to see it. And Katie, you really ought to forge ahead and at least get to that point because.
But is it plot reasons that you feel like
what?
It's?
No.
It sounded more like an aesthetic thing or like an experience.
That is the plot of Twin Peaks. I mean, like we're not talking. There's been a lot of talk about separating story from meaning
right.
in the show, and I think that's a really sort of a false way of looking at this because I think in so many of the great films and now television shows, and certainly with David Lynch, the two are inextricable from each other. Like everything, no matter how plotless it may appear, is in its own way contributing to the story and moving it forwards or sideways or downwards. And the eighth episode of the show, which for the most part takes place in the 1940s, involves a there are a lot of sequences that border on the abstract or a word that no longer means anything, but experimental. A lot is experimental in the context of network and cable television. But the imagery, it's nightmare-inducing. I mean, it's truly the most terrifying thing I've seen in a very, very long time, but not in a way that made me want to look away. I mean, it's so captivating. But it all gets to the terror, this underlying sort of primal fear underneath all and evil that is backstopping everything about Twin Peaks. I mean, it could not be more central to what he's trying to do, even if it takes place apart from the story and introduces characters that we may never see again. So
that's what I like about the kind of vignette aspects or the abstract. I was watching episode 5 and 6 last night and thinking about like Roy Anderson films
sure.
where I'm not necessarily sure how we're getting from point A to point B, like why this vignette, why now, but you recognize the people on some level, the situation makes sense, and now you're watching someone play, and the audacity of getting these images on screen is the pleasure. It's not about plot, even though there's familiar aspect. Character becomes a familiarity to guide you through these kind of like dream images. And I'm curious about, you know, you're talking about the separation of plot and visual, and maybe we don't need to kind of divide those. And I was thinking a lot about that reading, and this is a total tangent, but I'm not sure if you guys read this short story on SB Nation by John Boyce called 17776, which is about the future of football. I'm guessing maybe.
I read the first part of it, and then I forgot to check for the
Yes, continue. It's still going. And it is just this bonkers, I mean, it. To be quite honest, as someone who doesn't follow football, doesn't read SB Nation very often, I follow John Boyce and some of his more bonkers visual games and experiments with Madden football video games. But he just wrote this crazy story. And at first, I had to message people, like, what does this mean? What am I missing something fundamental about this article? And then I started to realize, I think people were just enraptured by its display, the fact that someone could put this all together, these crazy images and this crazy futuristic veneer to conversations that feel like I am conversation. It reminded me of The World of Tomorrow. So, David, you should check this out if you haven't seen
Hertzfeld's it. Don Hertzfeld's finishing his new film right now, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah, very it's excited. This story is very Hertzfeldian. But then I thought about Twin Peaks, too, about like when do you really need to know what's going on to enjoy something? And that's how I've been. I've just been glued to Twin Peaks. Not because I'm a diehard fan who followed every episode of the past series and knew what was going on going into this one. I'm just like along for this ride, and it's kind of unexplainable. But, you know, I've been reading a lot, too, about transcendental meditation, which David Lynch has a lot of involvement in, especially over the past decade. And I see a lot of that there, too, like releasing and letting go and having a mantra and what you were describing, David, the darkness of the world and this kind of idea of transcending. I think there's something to that if Twin Peaks, The Return, is about something. It's about personal awakening and the parallel universes that may coexist in our everyday lives. But I don't really care, right? It's just really fun to watch because of everything David Lynch comes up with. But maybe there's more to the plot than Dave probably knows if there's more to the plot.
Well,
than
I mean, there's an exceptional amount of the plot, and there are numbers all over, and there are dropped phrases. Basically, everything that Twin Peaks was doing that was like groundbreaking in the early 90s, they've upped it up to like almost to a point where I don't know. What I find so amazing about The Return is that I rarely know what's going on if you were to sit down and be like, describe what we just saw in terms of the world building of Twin Peaks. But I never end an episode feeling like I didn't understand what the episode was about. And that's just been amazing because it's so purposefully obtuse. It's like usually with these series, be it, you know, revival series or mythology heavy series, I'm like scrambling to put together the pieces and to like try to guess where we're going to go with it. And that only lasted to me for maybe 3 episodes of The Return. Now I'm more like waiting for everybody to soak in the episode and have like a response to it. So I've been reading more reaction pieces than I usually do for television. Not so much, you know, jumping into the Reddit threads and doing the frame by frames, which is my want, because I feel like the show is delivering a consistent story every week. Just whether or not we understand the shape of all the cogs, we may come out of the series understanding it or not. But like, you know, there's a great evil that David was talking about that we got to see the origin of, but that's always been present. And there's a whole bunch of new characters subbing in for our, you know, fan favorite characters. And we have to put up with like this new version of Twin Peaks and only when get glimpses of something familiar to have it like twisted on us. It's been pretty amazing.
When you say the pieces may come together or not, do you feel like you'll be disappointed if you've been kind of like following the breadcrumbs that are being laid down and it doesn't do?
No, I think it's already done enough with its border story to, if it ended without giving any more plot, I think one would be able to conclude the narrative in their head and not be able to prove it correct or incorrect, just be satisfied with it.
Yeah, I mean, I no longer really feel like the story is really going to leave us grasping at nothing. I already think we've been given so much information. I mean, fans have waited for so long for any hint as to what might happen with this sort of evil Dale Cooper. Now we very explicitly know what is going on there and how that works, even if we don't necessarily know how all these stories are going to or probably going to collide in Twin Peaks. But we now have some very telling, evocative imagery about where Bob comes from. That comes in episode 8. And so on. So I think it's already been a lot to chew on. We're only halfway through. But I don't think I've ever seen a television show that is as exciting on a scene by scene, minute to minute basis.
Yes.
Just the sheer thrill of what you are going to be watching on screen next. And not just because you don't know what it's going to be, and because we're all in the dark, and because there are no next time in Twin Peaks, and the episode descriptions are 3 words long, although all that stuff helps. But just because, I mean, this is why art is supposed to work this way. I mean, you feel as though you are in the hands of a singular visionary, to use a disgusting term, who is going to take you places, and every scene, even the ones that don't necessarily grab you, pulsates with that energy.
It's about being literal, right? It's that most television for so long has been literal.
Yeah.
Based in reality, families or work coworkers, or it's so grounded because the roots of it were like theater or something. It was about conversation, simple conversation, one or two locations. TV had to be simple and cheap, and we've grown it. I mean, David Chase is lauded for being this master of television, and which I mean fairly, but for being slightly abstract with where The Sopranos went with dream sequences and flashbacks and that sort of thing. And then Breaking Bad, that's an extension. This is why Mad Men is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, television show of all time, because it could take a step into the abstract for 2 seconds. And now you have Twin Peaks, which is just completely abstract. I mean, it feels more familiar because it actually has the foundation of the past series, which kind of stuck to the realism a bit more. I guess that's a bit of a stretch, but at least it was a real place and kind of soap opery, everyday drama. But like, you're talking about literalism in TV, right? Yeah. We can't escape it for some reason.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see if this season is going to end up having some sort of grander statement about what television should be, as well as some sort of grander statement about Twin Peaks.
You think it's a statement about TV itself? Do you think Lynch gives a shit about like the state of media, the state of cinema.
I mean, I'm waffling all the time. Sometimes I'm like, this is going to end up being David Lynch saying, like, television's the great medium because look what I can do with it over 18 episodes. Or it's going to be 18 episodes of him making Fire Walk With Me be the most important film of his career retroactively, which would also be cool, I think.
I wonder if he'll make another movie. That's what I keep thinking about with each passing episode of Twin Peaks. Like, this can't be that expensive with...
He doesn't seem that interesting.
I know, but...
First of all, I think that... He said a long time ago that he was never going to make a movie, and he's stuck
for
a very long time.
I gotta hope.
But you never want to say never. I mean, I tend to take people at their word about these things, and then it always blows up in my face.
Steven Soderbergh, man,
Miyazaki
here he comes.
Is a bigger one.
Jay-Z,
a
couple
Miyazaki,
of times.
I still sort of like part of
Jay-Z.
Me like, hopes doesn't make another movie. This girl or the caterpillar thing, because The Wind Rises was such a perfect way to go out. But then I don't know. It'll be a new Miyazaki movie in the world, and who am I to complain? But I think it's hard once you've had this sort of like dream canvas on which to work, and when you at the twilight of your career or something close to it, given all these resources and this toolbox that you've spent your entire adult life creating or at least thinking about and having associated with you, to the sky was the limit for him. He could do anything he wanted to for 18 hours. And maybe he wants to deal with other characters and other ideas since then. But certainly if there anything that came to mind, there was room to pocket it away in the vast world of Twin Peaks.
Right. It does feel like the ultimate note or something, like the farewell to this plane of existence. There's just so many shots of, you know, spiritual entities. Now I'm not as far as you guys, I'm too behind, but it's just like there's so much transcendence and moving on from the mortal plane that you have to, I guess this is the end for David Lynch.
It's hard to imagine that there were characters he wanted to include in Twin Peaks.
Right. He could do anything.
Like, this really is limitless space. I mean, do you guys, maybe this is a way to wrap it up. Like, I know we're all kind of in awe that this can happen on television, but no part of me thinks this is going to be a model for anyone else. Like, I don't think any other network is like, yep, let's give some other auteur 18 hours.
There's only one place.
Well, everyone's talking about.
There's only one show that should be paying attention, and that's the fucking X-Files revival, which keeps coming back.
Well,
they should take a look at this and be like, oh, we don't have to do what everybody assumes Chris Carter is going to do.
Yeah, I also wish that, like,
that's
and I think, you know,
point.
This is really a hope that's never going to come to fruition, which is sad, but I think some of the best television I've ever seen is The Nick, and there were recently Soderbergh was giving an interview talking about, I want to dance around spoiling The Nick, but, I mean, we know that the first two seasons of the show took place the very early years of the 20th century, and the third season that was planned was going to take place in the 1940s, so you can imagine that most of the characters are not going to carry over.
And be shot in like anamorphic,
anthropomorphic,
black and white. Anamorphic,
black and white. And I just feel like that was another show that, even though I'm sure Soderbergh had a little bit more oversight than Lynch has, because everyone has more oversight than it seems that Lynch has, except for maybe like Louis C.K. when he was doing the show on FX. That show felt like a pure unleaded shot of Steven Soderbergh, and I loved what he did with it. I mean, he made use of every frame of those 10 hours per two seasons, and the idea of picking that story up and setting it 40 years later and plumbing a new era of medicine and New York history through that lens, I mean, it's like, it would be pornographically satisfying, and it is really, really a shame that we're never going to get to see it. And I think had the show come along just a few years later, when you saw the impact of things like Twin Peaks, maybe Showtime would be a little bit less, or Cinemax would be a little bit less reluctant to plunk down the money.
Well, or they recognize that all of these networks are plunking down money, and we don't know how much money they make off of it. Probably,
I think
not making any.
That's
and then the
bigger thing.
The money fountain's going to turn.
That's
off.
The bigger thing. Like we're kind of many TV critics are like we're near the end of the golden age of television, or whatever this new renaissance is, because everyone has spent so much money creating television that there's too much television and no one's watching any of it, and everyone is going to have to pull back. The fact that Netflix is like canceling television shows is a red flag for a lot of people. And you know, this could be the last hurrah of abstract TV because no one did it before and no one's going to do it again after. You know, this is just the wrong time for it.
I think we'll...
Oh, it's such a down...
No, I think we'll have something from somebody new, but this is definitely, like, amazing coming from old hat at television and film. I think we're going to have to look to the youngins for whatever's going to fix our TV.
Facebook is going to make a bunch of television shows now.
I mean, not like that. I mean, like, young creatives, not like young companies.
We're all companies, Dave.
I need to trademark myself.
Corporations are people, too. That sounds like a good David Lynch movie. Corporations are people. Well, I am going to catch up on Twin Peaks. I don't mean to sound like I've given up on the show entirely. I wanted to air my difficulties.
He'd be disappointed in you if you don't.
I will.
He told me.
I know. Someday he'll know. Yeah, no, someday he'll understand what I did with my life after he went to bed and why I was so tired.
Yep, you'll realize he's been drawing Dougie insurance notes this whole time.
I finally understand your tweets to me the other day.
Yeah, there we go. You got there.
Good feeling.
It's your Twin Peaks second screen experience. Yeah. Dave tweets inscrutable things at you, and then 4 episodes later, you understand. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. At least some of us will have seen Dunkirk. So that could be interesting.
Dun, 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 Kirk.
Dunkirk, dun. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We published 100 greatest props of all time, featuring stories by all the people who made them. You definitely want to read it. It's like the length of a book. It's 28,000 words. It's worth your time. Carve it out. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes. You can leave comments to us. Dave usually screen caps these comments and sends them to me privately to make me feel bad, but I don't mind. And then fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me writing about everything from why Funny People is an overlooked masterpiece, the Great Gatsby of the 21st century, to what was it called? Valerian and the Whatevers of Planets. My review of that. Now live. You can find all of us together, not just talking about my shit, on Facebook. Fighting the War Room. It's a site that was started by our darkest timeline's future president, Mark Zuckerberg, and it allows people to network from across the planet, including you with us. So join us on Facebook.
Soon we'll be bringing you television, apparently. But, you know, whatever. Facebook. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. It's just super fun to make Patches feel bad, so that's why I do it. But he does also let me write for Thrillist.com. So while you're over at the props, go check out my Spider-Man work if you want to basically know everything about Spider-Man Homecoming that you need to know. It's important.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com. I'm also on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, where I will retweet the 100 best props list tomorrow. Just because I told Patches.
Aww.
You can also find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us and answer this week's lightning round question, which we do want to hear from you.
In honor of Thrillist's list of the best movie props of all time, currently online for your clickability, what movie prop would you most like to own in real life?
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm yawning. Ah. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.